What is normally often above the ark? Right. Well, okay. No, good answer. I'm sorry. The Neir Tami, what we're named after. What is usually two things on either, often, it doesn't have to be, ornamentally at, on the top right and left of the ark in many a synagogue? So, okay, often you get, good, often you get the Ten Commandments at the top. The shortened version that the Southern Baptists like, with only a couple words on it, or the actual Ten Commandments are much longer. But and then on the other side, you get two creatures.
Cherubim.
Good, the cherubim. Good. So you get the cherubim. In Hebrew, kiruvim, and so it relates to what I just said about a railing. You get the two monster creatures that guard the ark, and that are actually in Tetzaveh. So in the Parsha today, a little bit before what we read out loud, it talks about the fact that when you do the hammerwork of gold, and you're making the Holy of Holies, at the top, out of the hammerwork of gold, hammer the likenesses of these two kiruvim, these two cherubim, who are facing each other, and we're not exactly sure what they are. So what are they meant to be? So part of the theories are that in the ancient Near East, guarding the guarding various altars and are some kind of creatures like the Sphinx, right? The Sphinx, you have creatures that have one head and a different monster body, a different animal body and a different head. Scholars have speculated which of the ancient Near Eastern things that the Kiruvim came from, and one prevailing theory is that they were nearest in location to the Mesopotamians, who had griffins. So that the griffin is the closest thing. And so I'll save that for... are they in Harry Potter? I'll save that for a Harry Potter sermon one day. It's the only things the kids want to hear here ever is a Harry Potter sermon. So when I go into the Hebrew school, I turn everything into Harry Potter. It's a winner. So I'll save them for the griffins. Yeah. Right.
And you were commenting that it looked like griffins.
Good.
What is that? We wouldn't have thought of that as being a Jewish symbol.
Very good. So the one is that the griffins were of the peoples that were nearest the Israelites, they used griffins. So the griffin has, is it an eagle face and, or, as and a what's the body?
Lion body.
It's lion body, eagle face.
Right.
And it's got wings. Paul, you're allowed to. No, just like Paul's like, you know, and I was like, don't take off, you know. Now, the interesting thing there is that one of my favorite images in the Torah, and it was in my CD that I gave out at High Holy Days, I give a little shout out to it, which is God is portrayed as carrying us on eagle's wings. And when God says, don't forget, you're my people, I carried you on eagle's wings out of the land of Egypt. And it only occurs a couple of times, but it's one of the few symbols we have of God, which is like this eagle. Who, and then what do we do for the memorial prayer? The memorial prayer is that may the person I love, may their soul now be guarded under the sheltering wings of God. So we have these images of God's wings, and I love eagles. And so, like, I'm not saying God's an eagle, but the wings, thanks, Paul, became a crucial part of this in Jewish lore, maybe from our griffins, maybe from our kiruvim. We're not exactly sure what they look like. That's only one theory that they're related to griffins. Another is, like the Sphinx in Egypt, another one that was common in the ancient Near East was, it's a hybrid, they're always hybrid creatures, one body and a different head. Was that it would be like a bull body or a lion body with the head of, what did we, Rafi, read a lot? Of a stag, of a ram, or some of the, if you go to the land of Israel or you study, you read these books about the ancient land of Israel, there's so many different kinds of mountain goats and mountain rams, and they're like 10 different Hebrew words. So that different kinds of deer, different kinds, and it was a stag head. So if you took the Hebrew letters, so some of this is for fun. You took the Hebrew letters, cherub, or K-R-V. Those are the kiruvim. And the V is not a vav, it's a bet. So if you took K-R-B, the root letters of cherubim, kiruvim, and instead of saying cherubim, you you skip the im at the end. You take a keruv, and you make a kerub. It's very possible that the word caribou is the same, is from the same word. So it's possible that people speculate caribou was the stag head of other people's creatures. They would have the lion body or a bull body and a stag head, and maybe That's maybe where we get the word, because somehow. I always thought we got the word, which is that root means close. Your relatives is from that word. The near ones to you. It's the word karov means near. So I thought it's the angel that is near us, or the angel that is near the Holy of Holies. And when you make a sacrifice, the verb for sacrifice is to lehakriv, to bring something near to God. So it makes sense that and that's the word to sacrifice. So to sacrifice, you bring keruv to God, and they're the keruvim, the close ones above, but there's still a possibility it's related to the word karabu. So that was sort of the fun stuff to talk a little bit about, the possible roots of the keruvim. But I bring them up today for a more mystical aspect, is to ask, what is their function? I mean, do we really need... and they're ornamental, of course, although Ezekiel sees them as real. What is the function of having them? When I grew up, I was very uncomfortable because in my congregation, they were ornamented as lions. They really were kind of... they didn't have wings. So they were ornamented back into the Lion of Judah. And what are we not allowed to have in sanctuaries? Any images of people or animals. It's hardcore law. The Muslims are very strict about it. And I always told my dad that I was always uncomfortable with the fact that we had like these two lions in front of the Torah. And my dad said, yeah, me too. That's the sanctuary I inherited, and we're not taking them down. Not exactly sure we should have these likenesses here, but it's a beautiful sanctuary I inherited. And, you know, we're conservative. We'll take the middle road. So, And then when you get back to that idea of Arel and Ariel, that like maybe they were lion bodies with lion heads. Maybe they weren't hybrids except for the wings. So they, but then a lot of them don't put the wings on. So the way Jewish art evolved is not my expertise, but I agree with your speculation, which is the lion, because the lion was the symbol of Judaism, of Judah, that it somehow merged with the keruvim, the lion became a little bit... The lion replaced the keruv in the image, which is somewhat problematic because it loses its influence. Okay, so I want to share, which I've never shared before, Moses Maimonides' image of what angels are. Are the keruvim angels? Are they not? Right? Ezekiel seems to see them as a creature. Are they? Let me put my cards on the table here, which is, for the most part, our goal is to read the Torah as the rabbis read it, which is not anthropomorphically. Don't think of it as the Torah is describing a drama in which God is sitting on a throne, and the keruvim are, in a sense, like real monster creatures that are guarding God, and that are, it's all taking place in space, like in a spatial, literal way. So rather, somehow all of this that's being discussed is describing metaphysics. It's all describing the way the universe works. And we're trying to understand what it means to sacrifice, what it means to put that energy, where it means to put your soul in the grid of divine energy, in the grid of the reality that we all live in, the holy reality around us. It's not a physical act. It is a holy act. It's a physical act that transcends physicality and goes to the God plane, the God dimension. So I want to give you Maimonides' opinion on angels. What are angels? Are they this invisible? How are they invisible forces that have their place in the reality we all live in? Remember that the only thing I ever knew about angels from Hebrew school and stuff, which was good, I teach it here, is that angels have no free will. And angels are messengers of God, and they are like computer programs, that they're programmed to do something, and they do it. So if you're Raphael, if you're the healing angel, then you heal. You don't say, I like you, I'll heal you. I don't like you, I won't heal you. Right? I mean, you don't be like, you know, today I'm having a hard day, maybe I won't do my job. All the way angels are portrayed in the movies as having personalities is completely wrong. Angels are completely robotic. They have no free will. They are sent as a fragment of God or a piece of God with a mission. They automatically do the mission, And then they return, they're like computer programs. Listen to what Maimonides said, you know, many, 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 many a century before the medieval period. All invisible forces, all natural forces are angels. How blind, how perniciously blind are the naive? If you told someone who purports to be a sage of Israel that what is happening is that God sends an angel who enters a woman's womb and there forms an embryo, he would think, this is a miracle, and accept it as a mark of the majesty and power of God, despite the fact that he believes that an angel is like a body of fire one-third the size of the entire world or something. And when you say, wait a second, you're saying it's a great miracle and you believe that, they say, oh, that is a problem. But you know what? All is possible for God. But if you tell him, no, what this means is that God placed in the sperm the power of forming and demarcating the organs that will form in the embryo, and that the power that the egg and the sperm have, those are angels. And that all things in the world are produced by natural laws, and that they are the angels. And that this is what is meant by saying the grand angels of the Lord of hosts who are the regents of the worlds. They're referring to these. That person, the purported sage of Israel, will recoil and question your faith. For the naive person does not understand that the true majesty and power are in the bringing into being of forces which are active in a thing, although they cannot be perceived by the senses. And thus the sages reveal to those who are enlightened that the faculty within us that is called the angel, the faculties in ourselves are called angels. And the angel that is the mind is the cherub. The keruv is our minds. For someone who wants to understand, they will find this beautiful, but to the others, disturbing. I'm not saying how to believe in angels, but sometimes it's time to step back and understand what Maimonides is saying is like, wow, what is the symbol of the cherubs up there? What are they meant to be? And he's saying, first of all, if you're going to go and read Ezekiel and all this stuff and say, oh, yeah, you know, I believe in angels and they're four over there because they're four by the throne of God and the throne of God's over there and they do this and I hope it comes down and that's what all this means. He's like, no, we're talking about science. We're talking about the world, the cosmos. And every way the cosmos works, that's the miracle. And the whole idea that angels have no free will, that they are like in contemporary language computer programs, is like they're like natural laws. Gravity doesn't have a choice, right? Electromagnetic energy doesn't have a choice. You know, in a way, the sperm and the egg don't have a choice. You know, it's not like the angel of the sperm is saying, I don't know, I don't, you know, like, I'm not sure about this egg. I think I'll wait for a better one. I mean, you know what I mean? It's not like these angels are in there being like, I'm driving the sperm and I'm driving, you know. No, like, we have this need to personify. But if we could find that God is operating through the laws of the world, and that's what angels mean, it's a profound challenge in some ways to our need to mystify and, as he would say, make primitive rather than understand. And therefore, the cherubim, they're there to remind us that it is our own minds that serve to guard the Torah from its threats. And it's our own minds that serve to be the conduit to bring our offerings near to God. So I'll read from the rabbis in Leviticus Rabbah. I read it last night. It's an amazing, amazing piece. I'm still working on it. We'll be all year. When a person sleeps, this is what dreaming is. When a person sleeps, the body tells the neshama, tells your neshama soul, what it has done during the day. So your physical reality communicates to your soul. I'm not sure why the soul didn't know it already. There's something about sleep that lets, like what's been stored up in your brain and the other things, that your memories of the day then get transmitted to the neshama. And they take that report to your soul. And then your soul reports it to the other part of your soul, which is the nefesh, which is your breathing, living, emotional energy. And then the nefesh transmits that to the angel. It transmits it to a messenger, and that goes to the cherub. And the cherub sends it up to God. So thinking now in my mind, it is, on the one hand, I've read it before as like this amazing thing that somehow your soul didn't have time to understand what it experienced during the day. The day is material and bodily. Somehow when you sleep, it's like all those neurons and synapses, the stuff that Maimonides is talking about, the powers that are inherent in you, are in your mind, in your soul, in your body, they somehow communicate, they get filtered out to what was important. You know, what is going to be preserved in memory? What is going to be preserved in your understanding of your life, in your self-narrative? And then that gets transmitted to, it's delivered to the mind, the cherub. And that mind is connected to God. And then you wake up, and then how that message was received changes the world that you live in. I'll conclude with one final thought, and that is this. Just remember one thing about the difference between the nefesh and the neshama, because we have two souls listed in the quote. The neshama is the thing that the rabbis think gets reincarnated. It is the unique you. And the neshama is that, when I say you have a good neshama, I mean that's a very, Tony's soul is, it's like his DNA. It's a spiritual, it's a very specific neshama, and so is yours. And if there's reincarnation, which many of the rabbis believe, that's the thing that gets reincarnated. So what's your nefesh? Your nefesh is this life force, which is not the same thing. And when you die, the nefesh doesn't go back to God to be reincarnated. That life force stays in this realm. And in this realm, it goes somewhere. It is recycled. It's one of the reasons we bury in the ground, is the idea that that life force is renewed into the life of nature. But there's another way, when it's someone we love, and we wish their neshama in the memorial prayer to go into heaven and be under God's wings. Their neshama is going under God's wings, but where is their nefesh going? It's also going into us. When someone we love dies, their nefesh is trying to go somewhere. Not their soul, not their neshama. Their neshama is going back to God. But something about their vitality is another translation of nefesh. Something about this life force in them wants to pass into something that is in the living world. Could be the grass and the trees where they're buried. It could be somehow into a nature that's invisible, or it could be into you. And that when we say the cycle of life goes from life to death and death to life, after death, there is renewed life for us in this world, because the life of the person who died is trying to pass into us and not deprive us of vitality in our grief, but give us a chance to be renewed by having their spirit pass into us and make us stronger and make us more capable of any of the things before. In Maimonides' words, provide a new force that is within us as an angel and as a mind, as a cherub that resides within. Shabbat shalom.